Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... This is Chapter 1 of Zombie Myths of Australian Military History, edited by Craig Stockings, and this is chapters by John Connor, the first chapter, and dare I say, I was picking up independently or individually sort of documents occasionally. I would see and read and say, this just doesn't fit in with the overriding myth. So the myth that we generally had is that we came here and there was no real conflict. There was occasional sort of skirmishes or something like that, but essentially the land was unoccupied and people, the Aborigines retreated for some reason. It's a harder myth to stomach. But as I've read a few documents, I thought, oh, this is crazy. This can't be quite true. And now here's a bit of a gut-turning read through someone who is actually giving a bit of research to it. The overall idea is that there are these zombie myths in Australian history, and these are the military myths, so they tend to be reinforced and put together. I'm, of course, encountering a number of myths, like the myths of classical physics, myths in education, stuff like that. There's myths everywhere, or zombie myths, which are really hard to take down. And this is a bit of an education for me about how do you actually melt this thing away. It's basically getting the correct information to the correct people. But let me read it, and I'll try and add a bit of interest to my voice. Today, the Hawkesbury River flows through the suburbs that make up the western heartland of Sydney. 200 years ago, the river was the outer limits of the colony of New South Wales, and over two decades, the Darug Aboriginals fought the British settlers and soldiers along the Hawkesbury to prevent them from taking their land. The strength of Darug resistance was obvious at the time to the senior British officers in Sydney. Captain David Collins wrote in 1795 that, quote, open war had, quote, commenced between the natives and settlers around what is now Richmond and Windsor. So this is just 30 kilometres north of us on the plains. In 1816, the Aboriginals' attacks in southwest compelled settlers to flee their farms and forced Governor Lachlan Macquarie to deploy an elite flank companies of the 46th Regiment to the area between Camden and Campbelltown in an attempt to defeat the warrior raiding parties. So these are all localities that you drive through. Campbelltown to get out of Sydney. So you drive from the Blue Mountains down through Campbelltown and that hooks to the road down to Canberra. So these are all known places to us. And of course, you're out here and you occasionally see a bit of Aboriginal art and engravings on rocks and stuff like that. So it's obviously that's occupied. This chapter will examine the myth that Aborigines did not resist occupation of Australia by the British, a term which includes Australian-born British subjects. Okay, so this is an important point to go that, you know, what is now termed Australians are not the people who were there at the start. It will suggest that Indigenous Australians did fight and in fact developed a new form of warfare to combat the British. In some areas, there where the terrain assisted their tactics, Aboriginals were able to temporarily stop settlers taking their land. But the first, it was necessary to look at why the idea that there was no Aboriginal armed opposition to British invasion arose, and why it has persisted. The myth began because the British government refused to define the Australian frontier conflict as a war. Well, just didn't. There's a whole series of things that they did. To do so would undermine the basis on which the British had laid claim to New South Wales and their subsequent Australian colonies. Okay, there's a bit more geopolitical stuff. They weren't sure when they landed in New South Wales that it was actually connected to the rest of Australia. There could have been a big land thing through it. Large areas like Tasmania, New Zealand, you know, bits of the coast of Australia were technically Dutch territory, so they had a series of problems besides this. The British did not sign treaties with the local people, did not acknowledge their land ownership, and argued that all Aborigines had automatically become British subjects of the British monarchs. The British government had the view that Aboriginal armed attack as the criminal acts of misbehaving British subjects. If they accepted these actions were a war, they would have to accept the fact that Aborigines were sovereign peoples who were defending their lands. Okay, important point here. So this is, I mean, you've got the American occupation and African occupation. So it's really important that it's evolved to this particular point. Okay. Settlers and soldiers in Australia recognised this official stance as legal fiction and certainly viewed the frontier conflict as war. In 1824, William Cox and settlers around Bathurst in New South Wales informed Governor Sir Thomas Brisbane that the local Aborigines, who had killed 7 stockmen in 3 weeks, quote, may now be called at war with the Europeans. So that's a quote unquote. That's the people here would say, look, it's definitely a war. So to give you an idea, there's Sydney. You might be able to find that on the map on the east coast. That's the right hand side. About, depending on the scale of your map, a thumbnail in. You've got the mountain range, which is the Blue Mountains, a big canyon system. And after the canyon system are these vast fertile lanes, and at the end of these vast fertile lanes, fertile lands, reasonably fertile as far as Australia is concerned, is a main township called Bathurst, still today as you go out. And then there's nothing much after Bathurst, there's a few other places. In 1836, Lieutenant Henry Bunbury of the 21st Regiment told his father, a retired general, that he had been sent to the Avon River around York in Western Australia with the orders to make war upon the natives. Okay, these are all, you know, references. Despite this, the British government refused to officially accept the reality, as the British Colonial Secretary, Lord Glenelg, wrote to Sir Richard Bourke, Governor of New South Wales. So we've got these are all localities now. So Glenelg is a beach suburb in Adelaide, and Bourke is the whole area of, you know, the back area of New South Wales is called Back of Bourke. And this is a quote from what he wrote. Your commission as Governor of New South Wales asserts Her Majesty's sovereignty over every part of the continent of New Holland, which is not embraced by the colonies of Western or South Australia. Hence, I conceive it follows that all natives inhabiting those territories must be... So this is 1837. It's not too long ago, guys. Especially in European history, it's almost a blink. You know, the Napoleonic Wars have been... must be considered subjects of the Queen. That's Queen Victoria. As with Her Majesty's allegiance... and within Her Majesty's allegiance, to regard them as aliens with whom a war can exist, and again whom Her Majesty's troop may exercise belligerent right, is to deny them that protection to which they devise the highest possible claim of sovereignty. This has been assumed over the whole of their ancient possession. So their ancient, we've assumed control over their ancient possessions. You can imagine this type of stuff has had to be really covered before it's the legal stuff to go. So the thing is that it's not a war of conquest. In fact, technically this was no state conquest, but you could actually, if you shot an Aborigine, which is a horrible thing to say, you could technically be hung. And if you weren't connected with the system, you certainly would be. Yeah, you'd be prosecuted for many things, but it's really interesting to see how the laws slid away and then slid back, and who could do what. The official refusal to acknowledge that fighting in Australia between Aborigines and soldiers, settlers and police was war, as these conflicts would have been termed had they been taking place elsewhere in the British Empire, created the idea there must have been an Aboriginal resistance to, been little Aboriginal resistance to the Australian frontier. And so that is a general idea. And when you come to think of it, the Aboriginals are quite peaceful, and you actually see them making peace treaties very quickly all the time. The myths developed in the second half of the 19th century, that's the 1850s, as settlers in Australia and New Zealand applied the ideas of what would become known as social Darwinism to Aborigines and Maoris respectively. So social Darwin, so Charles Darwin wasn't accepted before 1850, and after 1850 he got accepted. However, this led to a whole series of nightmare regimes leading up to, ultimately, to the Germans and the Nazis and stuff like that. That is, that you've got inferior races and they die out. These people were now seen as members of inferior races who could not compete with Europeans and would inevitably therefore become extinct. As George Nichols stated in New South Wales Legislative Councils in 1849, so Nichols, I think this is a famous first for Melbourne University quote. This is, it's painful to even read this, I'm reading this a bit ahead. There is no doubt that such a race as must give way before the march of civilization, quote, they could not be instructed and must eventually perish from the earth as white men approached to occupy it. I don't believe it. God, it's just so stupid. 7 years later, Isaac Featherston told the New South Wales Parliament that Maoris were doomed to extinction and that all settlers could do was smooth down their dying pillow. This phrase would soon be common in Australia as well. In 1876, Henry Rusden wrote in the Melbourne Review that, quote, we invoke the remorselessly fulfil the inexorable law of natural selection when exterminating the inferior Australian and Maori races, the world is better for it. Quote, this is just disgusting stuff. Now, you've got to understand that legislation built at this stage was still in force into the 1930s and 40s, so it's an amazing thing. In Australia, the idea that Aborigines were a lesser race who were doomed to extinction persisted well into the 20th century. In 1935, the Australian Do You Know book, a promotional publication produced by the soap manufacturer Lever Brothers, assured the young readers that Indigenous Australians are fast dying out and in less than a century there will be scarcely a trace left of the Aboriginal race. It's from a soap company, my God. In 1949, the Australian historian Marjorie Barnard described Indigenous Australians as a people worn out and defeated in the evolutionary cycle. These are all quotes.
I must admit, this is some of the stuff that I would be reading, sort of wide reading across, and I go, oh my God. And there's also, there'd be British inquiries, and they would get depositions from Australians or other people like that to work out what's going on, and just the nature of the questions and the inquiries, it's an amazing read. The idea that Aboriginal disposition was an inevitable effect of natural selection entrenched the myth that there had not been any Indigenous resistance in Australia. So you've got Darwinism and no resistance. If we accept both together, we can get to go ahead. Anna Scott, a British-born Australian historian, reflected this prevailing view in 1910, when he wrote, that's not long ago, when he wrote, quote, Australia is the only considerable portion of the world which has enjoyed the blessed record of unruffled peace, a map of the globe coloured crimson as to those countries whose blood had flowed in armed conflict between men would present a circling splash of red. But the vast island, which is balanced by the Tropic of Capricorn and spreads her bulk from the 10th parallel of south latitude to the roaring 40s, would show up white in the spacious diagram of carnage. No foreign foe has menaced her thrifty progress since the British planted themselves in Port Jackson, which is Sydney Harbour, I'm saying that, in 1788. That's when the first fleet arrived, so Cook, quote-unquote, discovered Australia in 1770 after the 1769 thing, and 18 years later, the Poms arrived. Now, nor have any internal broils of serious importance interrupted her prosperous career. So this is amazing. So he's saying if you, this is the way that people wrote back then when they didn't have computer graphics, they would write a big piece, which would describe a piece of computer graphics, which indeed tells you much more information than a computer graphics. The myth continued largely unchallenged until 1968. It was the watch year when W.E.H. Stanner coined the phrase the Great Australian Silence to describe the way that most Australians and most Australian historians ignored Aborigines. Stanner pointed out that in the, quote, archives of all states, there is ample material to prove that Aborigines fought a very vigorous and, if unavailing, battle, quote, end quote, to defend their land. From the 1970s onwards, the silence was broken with an avalanche of publications. But in many cases, these books continued to perpetuate the myth that Aborigines had not resisted the British. Some authors, keen to stress the iniquity of Aboriginal disposition, described every violent incident at the frontier as a massacre. Which is really interesting. It is true there were many massacres of Aborigines, but sole concentration on this aspect of the frontier conflict had the effect of turning Aborigines into, quote, passive victims who had not made any active attempt to fight the British invasion. So this is one point I did in a publication I wrote, as I went through all the historical records and tallied out the number of Aborigines killed per year. I mean, it's a horrible thing to do, but there's the official records aren't all that many. I think in any one particular year, it sounds an awful lot, but for the estimated population, so the estimated population decrease is much bigger than the massacre increase. And I can sort of remember some years edging up towards 1,000. This is official persecuted things, so there must have been a lot of unofficial stuff. Other authors, most notably Keith Windschuttle, oh, I remember him, minimised Aboriginal resistance by following the footsteps of Ernest Scott in asserting that there had not been a war on the Australian frontier at all. Windschuttle's Fabrication of Aboriginal History, which examined the frontier at Van Diemen's Land, now Tasmania, so this Van Diemen's Land, we said, so it's after Abel Tasman, it is a Dutch possession, contended that the raids of Tasmanian Aborigines could be defined as criminal behaviour rather than warfare. He said that there was no frontier war in Van Diemen's Land because Aborigines attacked civilians and not soldiers, and because they lacked political objective to form and organise to achieve their end. That's just insane, because the Europeans have been fighting the all over the place, and of course they just didn't understand the Aborigines. Windschuttle's argument that the frontier conflict in Tasmania is not war cannot be sustained for two reasons. First is the argument of, that a conflict requires proof of political objective before it can be called a war is at odds with Windschuttle's own writing. In the fabrication, this is technically good, but intellectually weak, it's hard to say. I like this. Sometimes when I think I've found a hole in someone's argument and they can disprove it, I miss the fact that they're driving a freight train right through you regardless. They're committed to knocking you out. So you can't say, good point there. You can't do that. Because if you do that, you'll contradict. Oh, and they've just burst your way through. But let's listen to what he has to say. He accepted the Aborigines carried out an intertribal warfare, which without the need to prove political motive. So if the Aborigines were warring against themselves, why is it when they warred against the whites that's no longer war? That's quite a good point. In 2003, Windschuttle wrote that there can now be little doubt as far as the fact as we have credible archaeological and anthropological evidence. Human beings have inhabited not a realm of peace but a world of war. We can know warfare existed in prehistory because we can find evidence, such as weapons, skeletal remains, that a war had been fought. However, if there are no written records, we will never be able to know the politics behind the reason why the war was fought. The second difficulty... Oh, so that's actually quite good. So you can say there's a war from this evidence, and that's my evidence of war. So this is surely evidence of war. However, I think this is probably a weak argument. The second difficulty with Winnie Chuttle's definition of war is that it ignores military historian Geoffrey Gray, who pointed out that the Prussian military thinker Karl von Clausewitz, classic definition of war, so Clausewitz is sort of the basic bread and butter of all Australian military officers. I can tell you, so you really study him, and they write papers on him all the time. So he's a Prussian military thinker. An act of force to compel the enemy to do our will clearly describes the conflict in the Australian frontier. Yeah, I think if you pushed it through the Australian Army Journal, it would come out as a war, because the terms really go from my head. There's not an axis, a centre of gravity. Yeah, this is really interesting to read all the theoretical aspects of it and how it corresponds to, centre of mass. Is it centre of mass? It's really interesting to read the theoretical stuff. Okay. Aboriginals did indeed resist British invasion and settlement of Australia. However, the Australian frontier was not universally violent. In some areas, especially coastal regions, there was little armed conflict as Aborigines and settlers found ways to coexist and share economic resources. Where warfare did take place, the scale of fighting was smaller than on frontiers of the British Empire. Aboriginal groups were small, and their numbers declined even further as they were consumed by pandemics of introduced diseases. Oh, poor things. The small number of Aboriginal warriors available meant they could be matched by an equally small number of soldiers, settlers, and police. Casualties may have been comparatively few compared to other wars, but it's important to note that the cost in lives was proportionally high for the small Aboriginal groups. Where the Aborigines fought on the Australian frontier, they utilised a combination of their traditional tactics of raiding and ambush and new techniques developed to deal with the new enemy. British settlers took land, which seems to have been a rare occurrence in traditional Aboriginal warfare. This is right. So you've got to understand that possession of land was not understood. It was not understood that I would own land, because it just wasn't a concept. So land was the religion, the spirit, the ownership, all the things, but to actually own land was a foreign concept, and used it to establish farms, grow crops, and graze animals. The Aboriginals realised that these introduced crops and animals were the means, by which settlers could most effectively attacked. Aboriginal groups took crops such as corn, killed and maimed sheep and cattle, and set fire to fences and farmhouses. In areas where the terrain assisted this style of warfare, Aborigines, despite being outnumbered and lacking firearms, were able to temporarily hold back the British. Aboriginal groups offered effective resistance to the occupation of their land in many parts of Australia. In 1794, so that's 6 years after they've landed, Colonel Francis Grouse, there's the Jameson Valley, which is sort of where Glenbrook is connected to, but the next valley over is breathtaking. I can't say, if you come out to Australia, go and see the Grouse Valley. It's just, you feel as though you could suddenly see a pterodactyl fly through. It's the most amazing, colourful valley to cross. Okay, so we're back here to Francis Grouse, acting governor of New South Wales, because I think there's a rum rebellion, what happened here, granted the Hawkesbury River west of Sydney to settlers to farm corn, but the land had already belonged to a local Darug people who gathered yams for the fertile river flats. So yams is, this root you dig up. So although the Aboriginals weren't into farming, they were basically into culture. And now it's interesting that the practice of planting yams, or cultivating yams, so Aboriginals traditionally considered hunter-gatherers, but there's some evidence that their contact with the Dutch early on has led to a changed behaviour. It could be used to grow yams or corn, but not both. So therefore, you've got a conflict to the land. This particular conflict over land became the first front of Australia's frontier war. In September 94, the British on the Hawkesbury had killed at least 10 Darug. On October, some settlers took a Darug boy and bound him, tortured him, and pulled him through the fire, threw him into the river, and shot him dead while he was trying to swim to safety. This is awful. The Darug responded in kind to the settlers' violent invasion of their land. In the first 5 months of 1795, they killed 5 British men. Darug resistance panicked the settlers. Colonial William Patterson and local garrison commander acting governor wrote, quote, "I very much fear that they would have abandoned the settlement entirely and given up the most fertile spot which has yet been discovered in the colony. To prevent the..."
And can I say, Sydney, we're just unbelievably infertile land. Just
mountains and stuff like that. It's amazing. It's really just sand. It's like trying to grow something on a beach. You know, I don't know if you've ever had a sandy beach where you are. To prevent the settlers fleeing the Hawkesbury, Patterson ordered a detachment of 2 officers, 66 soldiers, and 3 drummer boys of the New South Wales Corps to march from Parramatta to the river and attack the Darug on the night of the 7th of June, 1795. After killing and wounding 7 or 8 Aborigines, the soldiers returned to Parramatta. In response, the Darug attacked a farm near Richmond, killing William Rowe and his child. Mrs. Rowe was wounded and survived the raid only by crawling into the river and hiding in the reeds. This attack forced Pearson to deploy a permanent garrison to the Hawkesbury. The Darug's continued raid to the Hawkesbury farm, led by Governor John Hunter, in October 1795 to request more troops in New South Wales Corps because of the need to keep a substantial garrison on the river. The Darug were the first Aboriginal people to develop new tactics used specifically in the frontier warfare. The focus of attack was not armed soldiers and settlers, but easier targets of settlers' crops and farmhouses. The Darug used these tactics in a sustained raiding campaign from over a 10-year period, 1795 to 1805. The 2 main Darug tactics were corn raids and farmhouse raids. Corn was easy to take, unlike introduced grains such as wheat and barley, and could be eaten without need for husking or grinding. Corn raids, therefore, were both a form of food gathering and a type of battle tactic. In the same way that cattle raids had been a form of warfare in Ireland in the 700s. An effective corn raid required large numbers, sometimes 150, and reflected a high degree of coordination between small Darug groups. The Darug often took so much corn that they ate their fill and stored the rest. When a teenage warrior, Tedbury, was captured in the Pennant Hills during the harvest of 1805, and according to the Sydney Gazette, a few, if any, of the outfarms ever escaped pillage, they showed his captors a cache of 40 bushels of grain. This is interesting, it's not corn. Farmhouse raids needed fewer people than corn raids. The average raiding party was 15 to 20, at the same time required careful collection of intelligence on the numbers of people living in the farmhouse, how many were armed, what they owned, and the best times to attack. This is interesting because there's still this type of thing going on a little bit. Once the Darug learned the English, it increased their ability to gather information and carry out such raids. And this is one of the things I really want to learn, the local Darug language. It's just a bit taboo for someone outside the culture to learn. The Sydney Gazette complained in 1804 that the Darug acquired the language only to apply the talent to mischief and deception. 3 attacks in 1805 at Port Hedland on the Hawkesbury were carried out using intelligence gathered from the farms by English-speaking 13-year-old Darug girl. The types of frontier war tactics used by the Darug found the greatest success in the Lower Hawkesbury downstream from Port Hedland. So, yeah, I don't know where the Hawkesbury emerges. I think it's at Port Stephens. It's a pretty amazing place. Here the river meanders through a narrow valley confined by sandstone cliffs and small river flats of richer alluvial soil deposits near its bends. The settlers tried to farm the flats in 1895, But we're constantly attacked by Darug coming down from the heavily wooded ridges and abandoned the districts in 1796. The British made a second attempt to occupy the Lower Hawkesbury, but continuous raids during the corn harvest of 1804 forced them to flee. Okay, well, that's after a couple of years then. Again, Governor Philip Gidley King subsequently met with three Darug men who told them they were raiding the farms because they had been driven from the rivers upstream and were attempting to retain some land with river access. King told the British Colonial Secretary that he thought the Darug's request appeared to be just and so equitable that I assured them no more settlements would be made lower down the river. King did not keep his promise, and the settlers returned to Lower Hawkesbury, but in July 1805, he managed to negotiate reconciliation with Darug and ended a decade of raids. The second major phase of frontier warfare on the Hawkesbury commenced in 1814 on the southern part of the watercourse near course known as the Nepean River. Well, that's so confusing. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's the Nepean River's our local river up here. Here, the Darugs were joined in their attacks of the British corn troops with the farmhouses of the Darwal and Gandagara peoples. So we have to acknowledge every time we have any public speaking, we have to acknowledge these people. We don't have to, we do. And we talk about the these people. When the Aboriginal raids began, soldiers of the Veteran Company were sent to defend the farms. The Veteran Company consisted of men of the New South Wales Corps who wished to remain in the colony when the regiment left in 1810, but were no longer fit for active military service. Three privates of the Veteran Companies were guarding Mills Farmhouse in Appin on the 7th of May 1814, when they confronted an Aboriginal raiding party taking corn. The soldiers fired their muskets, but the warriors, who knew how long it took to reload the weapons, rushed them before they could fire again, killing Private Isaac Eustace and forcing the other two to flee. By 1816, the scale of Aboriginal attacks had increased to such an extent that Governor Macquarie was forced to augment the Veteran Company with regular soldiers from the 46th Regiment to be guards or protection for those farms which are most exposed to incursions of the natives. These small frontier garrisons provided the settlers with some sense of security, but, as Macquarie admitted, it was impossible to protect every farm. Further Aboriginal raids caused the settlers to flee this frontier, and in 1816, Macquarie sent the best troops of the 46th Regiment, Light Infantry and Grenadier Companies, to an area to move against the Aborigines with orders, strike them with terror against committing similar acts of violence in future. British detachment killed 15 Aborigines, but their foe moved faster through the Australian bush, and many more evaded British force. A detachment by Captain I think they used horses eventually, is the main thing. Okay, the detachment led by Captain W.J.B. Shaw subsequently pursued the party of 15 more Darug warriors around Windsor for about 5 hours, but was unable to catch up with them. British troops returned to Sydney with their supplies run out by the end of April. Aboriginal raids recommenced, and the Macquarie sent out a small punitive expedition. By the end of 1816, Aboriginal leaders agreed to end the war in the Hawkesbury region. Elsewhere, Aborigines throughout Australia resisted the British encroaching on their land in similar ways. In northern Australia, the determined hostility of the Tiwi and Melville, so these are islands way, way up, it's crocodile country, and Bathurst Islands, and the Iwajia of eastern Arnhem Land forced the British to abandon military outposts of Fort Dundas, 1824 to 29, 5 years, and Melville Island, on Melville Island, and Fort Wellington, 1827 to 1829, on Coburg Peninsula. The forts were established so as to link up with the Muskeskin to link up with it, so this doesn't make sense. I think the Indonesian, traditional Indonesians, they're I've never pronounced this word, it's Makassians from Sulawesi. So Sulawesi is this fairly big island, it's the world's funniest island. If you ever look at on the map, it's so someone's had a proper island, bent it over many, many times. He visited the Australian northern coastline every year to collect Tepang sea slug for trade with China. Fort Dundas and Fort Wellington are significant as being the only fortifications the British Army built in Australia for the protection from Aboriginal attack. On 30th of July 1827, an 18-pound cannon was fired at a party of Iwaja surrounding Fort Wellington. This was the only second time the British had used artillery on the Australian frontier. The first was the 3rd of May 1805 at Ritson Cove, Van Diemen's Land, that's Tasmania, when a detachment of the New South Wales Corps fired a 12-pounder cannonade originally from Matthew Flinders' ship, so it's a slightly smaller gun, for the Tasmanian Aborigines. Now, Matthew Flinders had a really crap ship, the Endeavour. So the Investigator kept on throwing out his cannon, or giving them. And Keith Winchuttle, in The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, erroneously describes substantial naval cannon as a small ship's weapon, and still kept at Ritson Cove for ceremonial purposes. So I would say it's actually a small weapon, okay, as far as ships were concerned. At Fort Dundas, the Tiwi kept the British garrison in a virtual state of siege for 5 years. The Tiwi's belligerent also meant the Macassians avoided the island, which meant no trade was possible. So I don't quite understand. So they were trying to help the Indonesians in. I don't understand. The Macassians did visit Fort Wellington during 1828 and 1829 sea slugging seasons, but Sir George Murray, the British Colonial Secretary, wrote, "I do not think there is any possibility of advantage sufficiently strong to warrant the continuance of the expense, the risk of life, of either fort." Both garrisons were subsequently withdrawn. In 1820, at Bathurst, across the Blue Mountains, okay, this is where I am, this is the mountain from Sydney, the Wiradjuri fought the frontier war that was caused by the change of the British government's convict policy. Yeah. So they privatised. You cannot believe the amount of privatisation in what the British did. It's pretty messy. Instead of convicts being employed by colonial administrations to work on government projects, as had previously been the case, the convict system was privatised. Settlers were granted large tracts of Wiradjuri land and assigned convicts to work with the area, with the settlers, would clothe and feed the convicts at no cost to the government. So you can imagine these people are basically stateless criminals, ex-crims, so they're not going to be the best thing. The resulting increase in the number of settlers and stock animals, the number of sheep and cattle in Bathurst district went up from 34,000 to almost 114,000 between 1821 and 1825. So in 3 years, they've tripled the population, basically. Wiradjuri's traditional land use was under threat. In response, the Wiradjuri began attacking the settlers and their stock. In November 1823, John Maxwell, the governor of stock superintendent in Bathurst, wrote that the Wiradjuri had so intimidated the stockmen at Swallow Creek, west of Bathurst, that they abandoned it and forced the cancellation of plans to establish a station further west at Molong. In May 24, the Wiradjuri killed 7 stockmen in an audacious series of attacks. A letter to the Sydney Gazette highlighted the plight of the convict stockmen at isolated huts, where every sound conveys to the unfortunate the horror of a bloody and cruel death. The British soon responded to the Wiradjuri's raids on the 31st of May. After stockmen had been speared, 5 of the victims' workmates, John Johnson, William Clark, and John Nicholson, Henry Castle, and John Creer, asked the overseer, William Lance, for weapons and horses. They rode out armed with 4 muskets and a sword. Okay. They returned the evening claiming they had not seen any Aborigines. When 3 bodies were discovered, 2 weeks later, the men admitted they had killed them during a skirmish with 30 spear-wielding warriors. The 5 were charged with manslaughter and found guilty, although Sax Bannister, New South Wales Attorney General, wondered if they had truly fought a group of men. Why the bodies were found? Where were the bodies? Women. The ritually resistant, led by government, so that's just blatant war crime, led by Sir. But, you know, these are isolated people. That's so stupid. You know, I've got convicts, you know, you've got prisoners. He have some guns and horses. The ritually resistance led by Governor Sir Thomas Brisbane responded in three ways. The ritually resistance led the Governor Brisbane to respond in three ways. He increased the Bathurst garrison to 75 men. In addition, after admitting to the Earl Bathurst that infantry have no chance of success against the Aborigines in the districts that had been named for him, Brisbane asked for permission to raise a troop of colonial cavalry to operate the frontier. The third action, on the 14th of August 1824, was to declare the state of martial law west of the Blue Mountains. Brisbane did this as a direct consequence of the British government's position that all Aborigines in New South Wales had automatically become British subjects with the establishment of the colony. Soldiers who shot British subjects during civil disturbances, such as riots, could be charged with murder unless their actions had been sanctioned by a magistrate or a declaration of martial law. The governor's proclamation therefore meant that any soldier, settler who killed a Wiradjuri could have legal protection. Wiradjuri. In September 1824, a fresh reinforcements, the Bathurst Commandant Major James Morissette, was able to deploy a major expedition against the local Aborigines consisting of four parties of mounted settlers and soldiers from the 40th Regiment. Each party was led by a magistrate.
Oh my god, it's like the old days, the conquistadors used to have a monk, you know, some sort of friar with them, so they could kill whatever they wanted. The expedition scouted the area north of Mudgee into the Hunter Valley and east Warang near Lithgow. At the same time, private settler parties continued to pursue the Wiradjuri. William Cox's overseer at Mudgee, a man named Chamberlain, had two stockmen killed 16 Wiradjuri, probably all men, including a leader known as Bulcher. Wiradjuri attacks ceased, and during October and November, native leaders came into Bathurst to ask for peace. Brisbane revoked martial law on the 11th of December, 1824. It's August 14th of August to 11th of December. A few of the Wiradjuri delegation, including the famous Wiradjuri leader Windorain, crossed the Blue Mountains to attend the annual governor's feast for Sydney Aborigines. The Hunter Valley inland of Newcastle was the next site of armed Aboriginal resistance in New South Wales. In June 1826, following attacks of the Warran people on farms on the Hunter River above the Wallace Plains, now Maitland, and Patrick's Plains, now Singleton, soldiers were ordered to the frontiers. This time, the force consisted of mounted troops. At the height of the frontier war at Bathurst, Governor Brisbane had asked for the British government to allow the formation of a mounted unit, but permission did not arrive until 1825, after the Bathurst conflict had ended. The New South Wales Mounted Police Unit, however, was still raised, and despite their name, they were soldiers, not civilian police. The British government paid the soldiers, and the colonial government provided their horses and salary. One mounted police detachment sent to Bathurst were operated against the bushrangers, another deployed to the Wallace Plains at the highest navigable point of the Hunter River. This was the second detachment under the command of Lieutenant Nathan Lowe of the 40th Regiment that went to the Upper Hunter. The Australian newspaper in Sydney argued in June 1826 that the way to defeat the Hunter Aborigines was to strike these with terror by decimating application of firearms, which will ultimately prove saving of human life, and leave the people in quiet enjoyment of their farms. Lieutenant Lowe agreed with this method of stopping Aboriginal attacks. He and soldiers captured a man known as Jackie Jackie. Even I know of Jackie Jackie. In late July, Lowe ordered them to execute the prisoner. During the first 2 weeks of August, three more Aboriginal men were shot while trying to escape. When Governor Ralph Darling learned of the Mounted Police murderous activities on the Hunter, he stated that
quote, it's impossible to subscribe to massacre of prisoners in cold blood as a measure of a justifiable policy, and had Lowy recalled to Sydney. Lowy faced trial following a year for murdering Aboriginal prisoners, but the jury, who were all military officers, acquitted him within 5 minutes. The increasing British use of mounted troops made it harder for the Aborigines to offer resistance on the frontier. So they're actually paid by the British government. Horses gave soldiers and settlers extra mobility and speed and the range needed to pursue raiding parties. When a raiding party of 16 warriors attacked Richard Alcorn's hut, killing two and wounding two, for example, soldiers and settlers on horseback were able to track the raiders for 2 days and attack them as they were making camp at the night. Meanwhile, further south in the colony of Van Diemen's Land, the Tasmanian Aborigines attached such importance to the British use of horses that they devised a dance that told of a story of a man called Tarambuna, who was pursued by a settler wielding a whip but managed to evade him. From 1826, Tasmanian Aborigines were constantly raided the settlers in their farms, especially the hills around Oatland and Bothwell. Robert Sherwin's farm on Clyde River, for example, was attacked 4 times between August 1829 and May 1830. The types of Aboriginal raids forced the settlers to fortify their huts. George Robinson gave the following description of George Epi's dwelling near Lake Echo. Quote, like most stockhouses, a formidable construction is made by piling large solid logs horizontally upon each other, halved together at the ends, with a pothole to fire out of. The roof is barked and covered with turf so not to ignite. In the first 8 months of 1830, the Tasmanian Aboriginals killed at least 15 settlers. Lieutenant George Arthur, fearing settlers' response would be to destroy the Aborigines in a war of extermination, mobilised 10% of the colonial's male population along with soldiers and police to take part in an elaborate five-week operation which became known as the Black Line. To clear the Aborigines from settled districts, the Black Line failed to capture many people, but the scale disheartened the Tasmanian Aborigines, and gradually groups came in and agreed to leave their land for the Flinders Island Reservation. Wow. That's interesting. So Flinders Islands is a group of islands between Tasmania and Melbourne in the Bass Strait. The Aborigines fought on Western Australian frontier from... from 1830 to the 1920s. The most famous action took place at Pinjarra in the 28th of October in 1834. It was a British party of 25 civilian mounted police and soldiers from the 21st Regiment under the command of Governor James Stirling had what the Perth Gazette described as an encounter with natives on the Murray. On the 1st of November, George Moore, Western Australian Advocate General, described the, quote, encounter in his diary as the Battle of Pinjarra. Many writers have described Pinjarra as a massacre, but to do so masks the heroic actions of the Piranjup warriors that morning. Sterling parties had just crossed the ford of the Murray River when they realised the Piranjup camp on the side of the river they had just left. Okay. 5 British horsemen, led by Captain Theopas Ellis, were dispatched back across the river and galloped into the Aborigines' camp. The Piranjups unhorsed 3 of the 5, including Ellis, who later died from his wound. The normal Aboriginal reaction to the appearance of the British punitive party would have been to escape into the bush. However, in this case, they chose to stay and fight. Having seen off the mounted charge, it appears the Piranjups decided, as Stirling later told Moore, that they were in a position which I dare say natives thought was more favourable to their manoeuvres. The warriors advanced to attack the remainder of Stirling's men on the other side of the river. They dashed the fords, but Stirling had placed blocking parties on each one. When the British opened fire, the Piranjup jumped in the river and hid amongst the tree roots and branches, looking for opportunities to hurl spears at the enemies. This was a serious mistake. Taking a static position in frontier warfare surrenders the natives the initiative to one's enemy. With the Piranjups caught in the river, British systematically shot the bobbing heads until Stirling decided that sufficient punishment had been inflicted and ordered the bugler to call ceasefire. Stirling was impressed by Jim's courage and told the British colonial secretary, quote, the natives very resolutely stood ground. Wow. Contemporary British estimates of Aboriginal casualties at the Battle of Pinjarra ranges from 15 to 35 people.
Yeah, so you've got all these things. So you've got 100 encounters, at maximum peak of around 10 people a year. You can get up to 1,000, but...
So Europe were used to very large numbers of people dying. But as I point here, there are only a small number of people to begin with, so this is a good fraction of the population. Considered the camp to be reported to have held 70 people, casualties in this order would have been devastating to Perinjit. Oh, that's the same. 15 to 35 people, that's half the people. While Aboriginal traditions refer to the deaths in their hundreds, these numbers should be seen as symbolising the disastrous effect of the Battle of the Murray River on the Aborigines, then as a real assessment of the seas and the average of... Then a realistic assessment of the size of the average Perinjit camp. Back east in 1838, various Aboriginal groups attacked British settlers and their stock animals in several parts of Port Phillip districts in New South Wales, now Victoria. Okay. The Melbourne police magistrate, Captain William Lonsdale, complained that Aboriginal sheep raids were numerous and their attacks can seldom be guarded against. The raids were effective because they targeted the settlers' most prized position. Each sheep cost up to £3 to purchase and transport to the Port Phillip district. By the April, constant Tarangon attacks on the four pastoral runs on the Athens River had forced all to be abandoned. The settlers petitioned Governor Sir George Gipps in Sydney to levy a war against the blacks to sanction the enrolment of militia for the purpose. He was refused. The settlers were told that Gipps had to, quote, treat the Aboriginal natives as the subjects of Her Majesty's, and therefore was out of his power to authorise the levying of a war against them. At the same time, however, the soldiers in New South Wales Mounted Police were deployed at Port Phillip Frontier to inspire confidence and alarm the blacks. A few years later, in South Australia, Aboriginals' armed resistance at Blanchetown on the Murray River and Port Lincoln forced Governor Sir George Grey to send a detachment of the 96th Regiment to both places in 1842 and 1845. In the 1840s, frontier warfare also raged across the northern districts of New South Wales, now Queensland. In Darling Downs, soldiers of the 99th Regiment were stationed at Hodgson's Gap from 1843 to 1846 to protect carts and drays from Aboriginal attacks. From 1848, the native police used indiscriminate violence, this is the police against the natives, to squash Aboriginal resistance. As a settler from the McIntyre River stated, after the attack by the native police station in Kalandoon, quote, the blacks were so completely put down that on that occasion, that they never committed any more depreciations. The place was quiet at once and the property became 50% more valuable, quote unquote. There can be no real doubt that from the 1790s to the 1920s, Australian Aborigines fought British soldiers, police and British-born Australian-born settlers for the control of the continent. Bravery and brutality were seen on both sides of the conflict. The Aborigines were eventually subjugated by the world's greatest empire, but Australians are willing to recognise the gallantry in defeat. This is a very important point. You know, we celebrate our defeats. We were completely overrun. Other big celebrations. Oh, well, there you go. The Anzacs were beaten by the Turks at Gallipoli, but they are probably praised for their valour and resourcefulness. The 8th Division was defeated by the Japanese in Singapore. Well, that's sickening to read. But these men were rightly renowned for their mateship, endurance and captivity. It's only fitting, then, that the defeated Indigenous and Australian warriors should not prevent us from recognising their ingenuity and courage. Okay, and that's the end of that reading, Chapter 1. It's quite a moving read for me, and I think that's a really important point that we should actually, I don't know how we can do it, but acknowledge this as a war, a defeat,
And it's just that it's still going on. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. I'll get this uploaded. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.